details about the God that you serve. Because if you're getting your details from Hollywood, or you're getting your details from Nashville, or you're getting your details from academia, then you need to ask yourself, where are they getting their details from? I mean, does anybody who has a heartbeat on this side of heaven have the right to tell you what happens afterwards and how you should live your life so that whenever you get there, you will prosper? No one has that kind of authority. You don't have the kind of authority in your own mind to come up and say, well, this is just what I believe about Jesus. Well, says who? Because if you're not going back to the scripture, it's fine. You can make up a Jesus in your mind, but you just need to know that you are setting your life standard and basing your eternity on a figment of your imagination, and your imagination isn't going to be what sustains you in eternity. Who's the real Jesus? Well, he's the real Jesus is the one based on everything that I've seen and all the evidence that I'm willing to calculate. He's the one I read about in scripture. But that raises another question. Not just which Jesus are we going to consider, which Jesus are we going to focus on, but what aspects of Jesus? He is, after all, God in the flesh, multidimensional. You think your spouse is complicated, complex. Jesus is very complex and complicated. He is so magnificently detailed, and his facets are beautiful to behold. And any of those facets can be incredibly encouraging. But the author of Hebrews has three in particular he wants us to think about. So let's walk through this text together and see what they are. Look with me, if you will, at verse number 5. The author picks up where he's left off. He's just been talking about angels and how that you and I, we have a special place in God's heart and God's mind, because God did not say to the angels, right, sit here until I make your enemies my footstool. He said that to Jesus, and Jesus was made a little lower than the angels and came down to earth to minister to humans. And so the author picks that up. Watch what he does here. He says, for it was not to angels that God subjected the world to come, of which we are now speaking. Now, why is he dealing with angels? He's going to mention them several more times. I think what's happening here, a number of things, but in particular is this. We, apparently, as a species, were not the first ones to fall. The angels also had a fall of their own. We read about it in Scripture. They were led out by one individual whose name was the deceiver. And this individual led a huge cast of angels out and rebelled against God. And when we look at that story, what we notice is there's no redemption narrative attached to it. They fail, and they were punished. And now we're told those celestial beings look down in this little pocket of universe here, this little bubble that you and I live in, where we all go about in our own selfish, arrogant lives, and yet God condensed himself into that bubble, and he became a man and lived among us. He tabernacled with us to redeem us, and Scripture tells us these are things that angels long to look into. Well, no wonder. What a bizarre thing for a holy, just God to do. And yet Jesus has done that for you and I. And the author of Hebrews follows this, and he says, he points back, he says, it's been testified somewhere. Now, this isn't like the author saying, I don't remember where it was, but it's somewhere in the Old Testament. No, this is a very familiar passage of Scripture. This is how the Hebrew rabbis would write to teach about Scripture, that the emphasis isn't on it was written somewhere, but it was written by God somewhere. This isn't, in other words, the author saying, this is my opinion. This is written by God himself. What is man? He's quoting from Psalm chapter 22 here. What is man that you are mindful of him, the Son of Man, that you are you care for him? Actually, this is Psalm 98. You made him, he says, a little lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor, putting all things in subjection under his feet. Now, this is a creation psalm. This is a psalm that they came in and they worshiped God because of this incredible creation. They were able to look out and see the stars of the heaven, realize they could not be counted, and they were magnificent beyond our imagination. And yet God is concerned with what happens on this rock. And the author of this psalm looks and says, "What? We're so insignificant. We are so irrelevant. And yet you're mindful of us. You consider us, and you've made us just a little lower than the angels, and you put all of this creation in subjection under our feet." And that's how the psalm was sung for many years, and they understood it to refer to God's creation, to people, but specifically to God's people in particular, to the Jewish people, to God-fearers. But then the author raises this question. He says, but hang on a second. Now, in putting everything under his feet, speaking of man's feet, human's feet, in putting everything in subjection to him, he left nothing out of his control. In other words, what the author of Hebrews is saying here is that all means all. If God says he puts everything in subjection under his feet, it must be everything that's in subjection under his feet. Now, let me just pause here for a second and ask, am I the only person who has a problem with that verse? I mean, does it look right now like the world is in subjection under our feet as a species? Does it look that way? I mean, does it look like anybody's in control of what's happening here? I mean, we could talk about the weather and we could talk about the storms, but I would rather talk about what you see on the evening news. I mean, right, we look at it and the temptation is to believe, man, we're not in control of anything. If anything, we've made a mess out of the whole thing. Now, of course, those of us who are familiar with this passage understand that this is lifted up multiple times, and we know that it's not pointed necessarily to us. But even that creates problems, because I look around and I'm like, okay, specifically, I know he's pointing to Jesus. Like, ultimately, the psalmist looks through eternity and he sees that God is subjecting the world to humanity, but specifically, he's subjecting the world to one person, one human, who is Jesus, who becomes the Messiah himself. And yet I look around and still I don't see things in subjection to him. The author of the Hebrews had a problem with this too. He said, at present, we do not see everything in subjection to him. I think at this point, he's still pointing back to humanity. He's saying, look, nobody appears to be in control of this. It's a mess. Can you imagine how this must have felt to the readers, to the listeners of this letter? They've lost everything for following Jesus. They're suffering. Some of them, they're being ostracized, they're being beat, they're being maligned. They are suffering in a way that you and I only pretend to suffer. And the author of Hebrews stands up and says, look, I get it. Everything is supposed to be in subjection under their feet, under this created order in some way. Somebody is supposed to be in control of it. And right now, let's just all agree, it's chaos. We can't see all things in subjection under his feet, but what do we see? But we see who, church? Him, right? We see him who was made a little lower than the angels, namely, and this is the very first time in the book where the author mentions the name above all names, namely Yeshua, namely Jesus. He just drops it right there. We see him. And he has been crowned with glory and honor because of his conquering, because of his success, because of his freedom, because of his ability to deal with difficulties on Monday morning or to handle the objections of the other side. No, he is crowned with glory because of the what, church? The suffering of death. I love how the author just goes ahead and he kicks this up to 11. Like, if he's going to talk about suffering, there's a lot of things he could start with, and He could talk about the difficulties in your family and your finances. He could talk about all those things, but he pushes all the way forward to the place where he talks about the greatest suffering of all. You may have financial struggles that I don't have. I may have health struggles that you don't have. Someone else may have relational struggles that none of us have. But all of us have that cold, chill awareness, that struggle, that suffering of awareness that one day I'm not going to be here anymore. We fear it. And Jesus came and willingly subjected himself to whatever that experience is on the other side of life, so that by the grace of God, he might taste death for everyone. Now, in a single sentence, like if I was going to say to you, I know you're about to take a nap because it feels like it's about that time. In answer to the question, when we consider Jesus and we focus our eyes on him to bring context and comfort to our struggle, this is the verse right here that is the linchpin to the whole thing. Everything else throughout the remainder of chapter 2 is simply unpacking this. Because when the author says, consider Jesus, we all know what Jesus he's talking about. He's talking about the crucified Jesus. And whenever he says, consider Jesus, we know which aspects of Jesus that he's talking about because he mentions them here in the next few verses. Consider Jesus, number one. Consider Jesus and the family he created. Number two, consider Jesus and the enemy he defeated. And number three, consider Jesus and the help he offers others. You can see that in the verse here, right? Set your eyes on him who for a little while was made lower than us. Why did he come to be lower? Because he created a family. Namely, the one who was crowned with glory. This references the enemy that he defeated. And finally, the third section, so that by grace, God might taste death for everyone. That's the help he provides. Let's look at these very quickly together. My heart is, I hope this drives you in the next few minutes to a place of worship. Number one, consider Jesus and the family he created. You know, our God is unlike any other God because he didn't just simply make a way for us. As in, like, from a distance, just carved a path with his magnificent royal finger for you and I to travel through from a distance. He didn't send an emissary to make a path for us. He came himself to create redemption for you and I. What does that say to us? That says that God isn't simply interested in making you and I less annoying. It means that he wants you and me. He wants us as his family. Look at how the author of Hebrews unfolds this. He says, for it is fitting, and in other words, it makes sense, it's rational, it connects together. For it is fitting that he, for whom and by whom all things exist. This is a reference back to verse number 2, talking about the power of Jesus that sustains all things and created all things. It's for him that same person now is the one in bringing many sons to glory should be made founder of their salvation, perfect through suffering. That he came down and partook with the suffering that you and I experience. He didn't separate himself from it from a safe distance. He got down and experienced everything that you and I experience. The temptation, yes. The sorrow, yes. The hunger, yes. The family frustrations, yes. If he had a football team, he would have been frustrated about that too. It's all the suffering, right? He went through the whole gamut of human experience. And look at the next verse. He who sacrifices, listen, for he who sacrifices and those he who sanctifies and those who are being sanctified have the same source. What's he saying here? He's saying, look, folks, I know suffering's bad, but the reality is if Jesus is carving a path from sinfulness to salvation, and that's the path that we're walking, and that path for him was a path through suffering. How much more must it be true that you and I will suffer? Because the reality is, if our master suffers, Jesus taught, we are not greater than our master, are we? If he suffered, then you and I are going to suffer. That is why he is not ashamed to call them brothers. And then there's these references to Isaiah chapter 7 and 8. Watch what he does here. He says, for, this is Isaiah talking way back in Isaiah chapter 7 and 8. He says, I will tell the names of my brothers in the midst of the congregation. I will sing of your praise, he's talking about. Now, this is a prophecy specifically about Isaiah's sons. One of his sons' name meant a remnant shall return. And another one's name meant there will be a great spoil that will be captured. But in the middle of talking about these two sons in Isaiah 7 and 8, there's that beautiful passage of Scripture in Isaiah 7:14, where God talks about sending a child through a virgin who will conceive and give birth to this offspring, and you will call his name what? Emmanuel, meaning God with us. What the author is doing here is beautiful, and it's very clear. He's drawing their attention to a familiar passage of Scripture that they would have known, both this one and the next one. He says, I will put my trust in him, which he says in Isaiah chapter 8, as we have it today. Behold, I and the children which God has given me. Specifically, he's drawing this attention to these children, especially in these two verses right here. And they would have known what was in the middle. Isaiah is talking about his son in 7:3. He's talking about his son in early chapter 8. And then right there in the middle, God places this comment about another son, his son, who will be called Emmanuel, God with us. See, God created a family by coming down here and becoming one of us, by becoming our brothers. So that now he looks at us and he no longer refers to us simply as servants, although surely we are that, but he says, God is your father. What a radical idea. And he is our brother. We are joint heirs with Christ because he became one of us and we became part of his family. That's enormous. Christianity is the only hope. Christianity is the only faith that portrays a God who says, I'm not just going to redeem you. I'm going to bring you into my family. I know you've wandered far away. And I know you've ran. And I know you've rejected me. And yet he pursues us and makes us part of his household. This is the beauty of what Jesus meant whenever he said, look, guys, I know you're afraid, but don't be afraid. I'm going to prepare a place for you. And the idea there is in my Father's house. In my Father's house, there are many dwelling places. You're going to come under his roof, and you're going to exist with him, and you're going to live with him because you're part of his family. How would that change my perception of suffering if I remembered that the most powerful person on the earth was my big brother? Consider Jesus and the family he created. Number two, consider Jesus and the enemy that he defeated. Of course, we've already been given this glimpse of death. Reference that this is how Jesus accomplished this. He accomplished our salvation through death. And in the Greek, it's very clear. It's written in a particular form, a genitival form. It doesn't really matter, but it's repeated here in the same phrasing to connect all of this together. This beautiful encouragement that through death, Jesus conquered death. Look at what he says here. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. He didn't exempt himself from any of it. That through death, he might destroy the one who has power over death. That is the devil. Pause there for a second. Please hear what I'm saying. He's not saying, and I think I even misread it there. He's not saying the one who has power over death. He has power, what does it say? Of death. Don't mistake this for a moment, that whenever Jesus steps out into this world to take on the enemy of Satan, this isn't like a mano-a-mano kind of, you know, equal powers, good and evil coming after one another. The devil never stood a chance. He has the power of death. He does not have the power over death. God is sovereign even over the grave. And now, in a very clear way, after the cross, by the power of the resurrection, we see that Jesus is very clearly manifest ruler over death. It's our greatest fear, our greatest suffering. In fact, the author points that out there. He says, it delivered all of those who are followers of Christ. He delivered all of those who through fear of death were subject to lifelong slavery. You ever feel like a slavery to that thought? That the constant pervasive thought that I know I'm not going to die today. I know for a fact I'm not going to die today, but I also know that one day I'm going to be wrong about that. And I'm going to go. What then? It's the uncertainty of the thing. The feeling in our heart, please hear me, the feeling in our heart that recognizes this is not how that was supposed to be. God has placed eternity in our heart. He's allowed us to keep that little portion of the garden and carry it through that recognizes that this is, that with every casket, with every dug grave, with every bloody death, this is not normal. And the author says that Jesus comes to be a conqueror over death so that we may recognize and we may see, we may consider the enemy that he has destroyed. Jesus, through the power of the resurrection, has proven that you and I will not taste death. Now, I don't know what that means, but I really believe, based on the teachings of Scripture and what we know about God's own heart, that when you and I as followers of Christ die, we do not die the way a non-believer dies. We will not taste death. Jesus has tasted death. Now, I know, like, that's, man, on tough days, that's tough to swallow when we think about what we're facing or what a loved one is facing. But can I just ask you, when it comes time to suffer, when we're facing that suffering, what hope do you have other than to consider Jesus and the enemy he destroyed? And I'm like you, I've stood beside a lot of caskets, a lot of grieving loved ones. Most of them, fortunately, have some hope that their loved one has surrendered in humility to the rule of Christ in their life. But when I was up in Illinois, I did a lot of funerals for people who I did not know, because they were not connected in any way to a faith community, had no idea or consideration for the work that Christ could do in their life. I heard them weep. And then I would go into another funeral of a follower of Christ, and I heard their family weep. And I'm here to tell you there's a difference in the tears. Consider Jesus and the family he created. Consider Jesus and the enemy he destroyed. Thoroughly consider Jesus and the help he offers. Finally, look back at this passage with me, just two more to go. For surely it is not angels that he helps. No. That story reads totally different in Scripture. No, there's a redemption plan. Maybe God did something with them and it wasn't told to us, but there's something about this happening here where God creates Adam and Eve, and they're there and they're in that garden, and God would come down and he would walk with them in the cool of that garden, in that special place. And now on the backside of that, God isn't simply going to redeem them from the mess that they made. He's going to bring them into his house and they're going to stay with him, and he's going to be their God. and they're going to be his people forever and ever, and he is personally going to wipe away every tear from their eye. What a hope. What a help that is in times of trouble. He didn't do this for angels, apparently, so far as we know. The author points out here, he helps the offspring of Abraham. Those who surrendered to the promise that went to Abraham, that Abraham through you, through your seed, singular, pointing to Jesus, shall all the world be blessed. Therefore, he had to be made. Very interesting statement. Anytime you read something in Scripture that says, he had to be made, and it's referring to God, you should stop and camp out on that for a little bit, because God is sovereign. He had to be made. To accomplish his objective, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in service to God. You guys got time for a deep thought? Man, this one racks my brain, because I know God is omniscient, which means he knows everything. And I know that he is sovereign, which means he controls everything. And I take those two things together, those two aspects of God's life, which I am neither one of those, so what business do I have in really trying to figure this out? But it leads me to an incredible place of worship when I look and I realize that in his sovereignty and his omniscience, that in his experience, he came down and something there in the incarnate Son, the experience of being here, helped him in a way that we cannot possibly understand. Please don't go out of here and say, Pastor Major said that God is not immutable. Look it up. No, I'm not arguing that. I'm just saying there's something about the experience of God here in the flesh that made him for us a faithful and merciful high priest. Faithful meaning that he could do the job. Like he is willing. He's able to do the job. He's faithful. He can carry it out, but he's also merciful, because it's not just enough for him to be able to do the job. He must be willing to do the job. And now the author of Hebrews is going to say later, he's going to point to Jesus and say, because he is just such this high priest who is both able and willing to do the job, because he has lived with us and experienced the sorrows and the sufferings firsthand. Because of that, we can approach his throne boldly. That's huge, ladies and gentlemen, because I don't know about you. Let me just see a show of hands. How many of you feel like at any point this week, you are righteous enough to approach the throne of God with your confession, with your prayer? Anybody? Not a single moment that I ever feel like that. And yet, because of the suffering of Jesus, because of what he did, he is able to provide a help for me that I can trust to know he's going to be there. So I consider Jesus and the family he made. I consider Jesus and the enemy he destroyed. And I consider Jesus and the help he provides. Listen, look here. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted as well. Now, I don't know. Maybe he was talking about the temptations, the three temptations. There were probably more, but the three temptations in the wilderness after his baptism. Maybe there were other moments where he woke up in the middle of the night and thought, is any of this going to do any good? Understanding the difference between his divinity and his humanity and kind of what he knew and what he experienced, like that. It's beyond our understanding, but we do know that he was tempted. We could see it in the garden as he falls flat on his face. Actually, before he goes and he falls flat on his face in the garden before the crucifixion, he takes his disciples in, and what does he say to them? Stop and pray unless you give way to what? Temptation. And then he himself goes in and he falls and he before the Father and he cries and he weeps because he knows what's about to happen here. And it's not about being beaten by a bunch of Roman citizens. It's about bearing the sin of humanity. And he pleads with the Father, anything is possible for you. Anything is possible. So if you can let this cup pass from me, please do that. But nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. That's a temptation like you and I will never face. And that's a suffering unlike you and I will ever have to face, because he faced it. This is why I love this quote from Dan McCartney. This is why I cry. For us, like as Christians, we turn to this and we recognize the power of what it does in our life. Christ learned humanity from his suffering. It's what the author of Hebrews has just said. In some way we can't understand, he learned humanity from our suffering, and in turn, we learn Christhood also from our suffering. There's value in it. I know it doesn't feel like it when you're going through it, when you're answering the phone, whenever you're working out the books, when you're turning on the news, whenever you're trying to figure out what to do next, when you're laying awake at night because there's a cold chill running down your spine because of what you have to face tomorrow or next week. I know it doesn't feel like it's valuable, but it is. We know it's valuable because it was through the instrument of suffering that Jesus, our apostle, our great apostle, and our great high priest, it was through the instrument of suffering that he accomplished the greatest things in our life. Now, how much more can he use suffering to accomplish still great things through our life as we walk through it? And the answer is, he most assuredly can. Therefore, the author concludes. See, I told you we were running it to the end, right? Therefore, the author says, holy brothers, you who share in the heavenly calling, consider Jesus. Consider Jesus and the family he created. Consider Jesus and the enemy he destroyed. Consider Jesus and the help he alone can offer. Consider Jesus, the apostle and high priest of our confession, who was faithful to him, who appointed him just as Moses. As much as the law is important and beautiful, Jesus did so much more in his suffering for you and I. I want to close this morning with a quote from John Stott in a book he titled, Why I Am a Christian. If you've never read it and are curious about the beauties and merits and reason of the faith that we're in, I commend that to you. It's a very short read, a very easy read. And near the end of the second chapter, he says this. The crucified one is the God for me. He laid aside his humanity. He laid aside his immunity to pain. He entered our world of flesh and blood, tears and death. He suffered for us, dying in our place in order that we might be forgiven. Our sufferings become more meaningful in the light of his. Ladies and gentlemen, with respect to our neighbors who worship gods of lesser love and mercy, I'm here to tell you there's no other God who does that. Someone who is powerful enough to see me through, but someone who is merciful enough to have walked through it himself, there's only one of those. He is the God for me. There is still a question, though, question mark, against human suffering, but over it, we boldly stamp another mark, and that, of course, is the mark of the cross. I don't know what you're facing or what you're going to be facing as a church, as a community, what's before us, those of you who are younger than me, what you're going to face in the years to come, but I can tell you this, that the cross has been tried and tested as a resource for encouragement and hope and support, and has been found worthy and able to bear whatever it is that you are going to face because of the work that Jesus did on it. He is the God for me. How about you?